The Decent Inn of Death, a John Madden mystery by Rennie Earth. O God, our help in ages past, our hope for years to come. Luckily, the choir was in good voice this morning. The hymns chosen were among their favorites, and with the lusty support of the congregation, they were drowning out the small mistakes that Greta Harkman made as her fingers stumbled over the organ keys. She played in a daze, the same thought running through her head over and over, the self-same words. It can't be him. Yet she knew she was not mistaken. Although he had aged, the hair, once so thick and lustrous, was thinner now. His face was not one she would forget. Their eyes had met outside for a moment, and she had frozen in the spot, unable to move. Luckily, he had given no sign of having recognized her. At the moment, he had yawned, and then looked down to say something to the boy who was crouched in front of him. But was his reaction, or lack of one, genuine? Greta couldn't be sure. The appearance he had always presented to the world made it difficult to guess what his true feelings were. Switching off the organ, she hurried to the vestry, where she paused only to shed her white surplice and don her coat and gloves before slipping out through the side door. The graveled path outside led around the church to the front, where Father Beale would be chatting with members of his flock. Not wishing to delay her departure, Greta picked her way through the gravestones to a gate in the low stone wall surrounding the churchyard, which led to a path outside that took her down to the road. There, she paused. To her left, she could see the village pub. It was called the Horse and Hounds, and the forecourt, which was empty. Opening time was still an hour or so off. Nevertheless, she hesitated a moment longer to scan the small paved patio at the side of the pub, where wooden tables lined with benches, much favored by the patrons in summer, but little used at this time of year, stood. She was relieved to find that it too was deserted, and for the first time, she began to breathe more easily. We're close enough to the metropoles of London and of Oxford, thanks to public transportation, which even in the 1950s was a source of pride to the British people. Anyone for a spot of Sherlock Holmes and Watsons hightailing around the island on the vaunted train system in the late 1800s, so many years afore? Well, our story opens as a now beloved German immigrant organist is found dead in a stream nearby that small village church, nearby that pub, the victim of her own carelessness in crossing the creek on a wobbly stepping stone. But her best friend and longtime housemate isn't buying the easy explanation of her death, the lazy officials want to let stand. No. Her housemate, more importantly her friend, is convinced there is more to this story, most likely foul play. And through a chance encounter with retired Chief Inspector Angus Sinclair, she enters someone with the wherewithal to do something about that unfortunate death. Sinclair is reluctant to get involved, for good reason. The crime, if that's what it was, didn't happen in his home village. And the crime, if that's what it was, has been investigated and solved by the local officials. Inspector Sinclair's retirement and his not-so-good health both argue against plunging into yet another investigation. But the search for the why of the death of the locally beloved older woman proves to be too much for the retired inspector, and off he goes, against his better judgment, on a chase that takes him to the university town of Oxford, to London, and then, as the snow begins to fall, to the small villages outside the university town, all the while ricocheting between his contemporary life and the not-so-distant past as he probes the dead woman's past as an immigrant widower from Nazi Germany. But as luck and the intricate plotting of a good mystery writer, a late winter, early spring snowstorm hits our erstwhile detective and traps him with a smart and savvy landowner who catches his eyes for other reasons as well, on her country estate outside of Oxford, near one of those small towns, throwing both Sinclair and his good friend the Maddens into a communications black hole. The Maddens, recently returned from their overseas vacation, find their close friend Angus Sinclair missing from his nearby cottage, and their worry over Sinclair's health and whereabouts get the better of their good sense, and another pair of characters enter our story. Thanks to the heavy snowstorm, the phone lines are down out here in the countryside. In our series hero, John Madden, worried about his longtime friend's vulnerable health, sets out in the midst of the storm to find him. Soon enough, joining his old friend and colleague in the snowed-in country estate. As another reviewer succinctly put it, we soon enough find ourselves in the midst of, quote, a classic country house murder in post-World War II England, with a blizzard obscuring almost all the tracks of the red herrings in the snow. But only almost, because not-so-retired Chief Inspector Angus Sinclair, with definitely retired Detective Inspector John Madden, faint but pursuing around the case of a killer who has left a trail of bodies that predates the war. Interesting twists in both the killer's multiple motives and in the shifting list of unusual suspects. And with a great visit with John, his family, and friends, it's a novel I enjoyed reading. End quote. Yes, indeed, The Decent End of Death has all the hallmarks of an engrossing English village mystery. We readers are often taken by the twists and turns of the plotting in a good mystery novel, but character development is not often a strong point. I'll mention the great Agatha Christie and the intriguing Rick Stout's many novels in this context. But with The Decent Inn of Death, we find a novel with twists and turns aplenty and with character development that hints at more than stock characterizations. For instance, Sinclair gets to that far-off countryside estate through a chance encounter with a psychiatrist who takes such an interest in him when they meet, by chance, in Oxford. Here's just a bit of that description. Sinclair realized it was a step he was reluctant to take. He had felt he had already gone beyond the bounds of what was acceptable. If he was still in his old job at Scotland Yard, he would have been more than a little peeved to learn that some retired detective long since put out to pasture was meddling in what was purely a police matter, if it was anything at all. His wisest course of action would be to return to his village in Highfield at the earliest possible moment and await developments. "Mr. Sinclair, I thought it was you." Glancing up, he saw the figure of Anne Waits standing before him. She was dressed as she had been before, simply, in a skirt and plain blouse. The only difference was that now she had a handbag hanging by a strap from her shoulder. The chief inspector rose to his feet. "No, please." She gestured him to sit, and without waiting for an invitation, drew up a chair and joined him at the table. "I was having lunch with a friend over there," she nodded behind her, "a colleague from America. I spotted you a moment ago. Only I wasn't sure at first it was you. You didn't say a word about coming to Oxford when we talked. And you did promise to get in touch with me if you did." Her glance was accusing. "So I did. Please forgive me." Sinclair had over his shoulder seen the surprise at seeing her. "I traveled down from London yesterday on the spur of the moment, quite literally. I was on my way to Waterloo Station, intending to return to Highfield, when I changed my mind and came here instead. I'm afraid it didn't occur to me to call you. There was something important I had to do in Oxford, and I was rather fixated on it." "That sounds very mysterious." Her tone was teasing now. "But since I've cornered you, I'm going to insist you have dinner with me this evening. I have a friend staying with me, the one I told you about. And I've invited another guest as well. Please say you'll come." She smiled. "Of course, I'd be delighted to." Cornered, as she had said, Sinclair was more than happy to accept the invitation. Apart from anything else, it resolved the question that was troubling him. Now he had no choice but to remain in Oxford overnight. He would postpone deciding what to do about the mysterious Mr. J.H. Beck and his village Chipping Norton the following day. Indeed, I found the writing and the characters in this novel reminding me of another contemporary favorite of mine, perhaps yours, the Inspector Gamache series of Louise Penny, set in her off-snowy neighbor to the north, Quebec in Canada. Indeed, the series of which this book takes part, the John Madden Mysteries, keeps John Madden in the background for much of the first third, even half of the novel, as Madden's old colleague from Scotland Yard, Inspector Sinclair, takes center stage, allowing our author to fill out Sinclair's story and those of the other characters we meet, much to our reading pleasure. Well, I'll not give away the plot or the many twists and turns that can occur even in the midst of an early winter snowstorm in England near the Atlantic coast. But suffice to say, there is plenty of nasty pre-war crime hinted at here, and plenty of twists and turns in the contemporary story to keep those pages turning. The Decent Inn of Death, a John Madden mystery, featuring John Madden, Miss Waits, Inspector Sinclair, and quite a number of other fascinating, interesting, well worth meeting characters. It's available at all of our fine local public libraries. Who wouldn't want this on their shelves? And certainly the West Lafayette Public Library. Thanks for listening.